It is 11 a.m. or 6 p.m. in Israel. So on behalf of Torah Moshe, I want to welcome everybody. Part two of our series, Come Walk the Land, and with Shuli Mishkin. And we look forward to another informative and exciting trip through the land of Israel, even if only on a virtual trip. One day we can come to Nahariya and make our own trips and go up north in the Galil. But in the meantime, we got to do it all virtually.
Bezrat Hashem. Okay, so... Hi, everybody. So today we're talking about the Negev, although as I just said to Rabbi Kalman, I just came back from the north. So I feel like I'm in that north head, but that's okay. We're going to be doing that next week and the week after. So we'll be fine. But today we are going down south to the Negev. The Negev, the title here is Israel's future, but Negev is also very much part of Israel's past. And a lot of Tanakh stories take place in the Negev, and just the landscape, right? Certainly when you're not in any of the cities, is very primeval, very much, you know, Breshiti, as we say in Hebrew, going back to Breshit, going back to the beginning of time. The Negev is a vast area. It's also a vast, it could be, and it certainly was in the eyes of Ben-Gurion, a vast area of promise. What he really hoped would be the future of Israel, and we'll see what that entails, what that means. So the first, I don't know, third, I guess, we're going to talk about the earlier history through up until the Middle Ages or so, and then we're going to jump forward to the 20th century and a little of the 21st. Okay, so this is Nachal Tzin. And really some of the very dramatic landscapes that we see here. Okay, so let's get started. First of all, let's understand where we are. Always good when we're doing these geographical tours. Okay, so this map here on the left is actually very nice, very helpful, but it doesn't really tell us what are the borders of the Negev. And that's because we don't really have such great borders, right? What does the word mean? Negev or linagev or niguv, right? What does that mean to dry something? Say you take a towel, a magevet. It's all from the same root. And so Negev really means dry. Dry as in less water than there is in other places. And that's really how we're going to define it. It's more comparative than anything else. There's more water in other places than there is in the Negev. In Tanakh, when we say Negev, it doesn't necessarily mean the place. It's also a direction, right? Yama vakedma tzafona vanegba. Negba is south. So as it is here, of course. So we are in the Negev. What are our borders? So the border in the most southern border, of course, is Eilat. Right, Eilat is more or less a natural border, right? We're at the Gulf here. The east is also a natural border, the area of the Jordan Valley, the Arava Valley over here, and that's somewhat of a natural border as well. The north border and the western border are not really natural borders, right? The north border, of course, you have all the rest of Israel over here, and the western border is bordering on Egypt and on the Sinai. And there, it's not a natural border as much as it's a border defined by rainfall, okay? If we say less than 200 millimeters of rain a year, which equals 8 inches, which is very little water, right? That's considered Negev, right? So less than 8 inches of water a year, you are considered the Negev. So just to understand it in terms of where the cities are, right? So that's why I brought you this other map here. The area north of Be'er Sheva, when you are driving down, there's signs, you pass an area called Beit Kama, which is right about here, and it's like, welcome to the Negev, right? And going down towards Eilat. By the way, if we're talking about rain for a second, the Negev is interesting. We see water is a major concern here, has been throughout time and still is today. And often you do get some rain, but it's very localized, right? It's very localized. You might get a lot in a very small area, and next door, you know, a few kilometers away, there's no rain. Plus, we're going to have the issue of flash floods. We're going to talk about that. In Tanakh, when we talk about living in the south, right? What do we talk about? What are the borders of the land? When it talks about King Solomon and the peace in the land, it says he has a kingdom that goes Midan ve'ad Be'er Sheva, right? From Dan. Dan, of course, is all the way up north near Kiryat Shmona of today. Dan is in two places, but that's a separate story, right? Until Be'er Sheva. It doesn't go further than that. We hear about King Solomon in Eilat, right? King Solomon has Etzion Gaver, he has ships, he has a shipping industry, but between Be'er Sheva and Eilat, nothing. That is not inhabitable land, certainly not in Tanakh times. even in more modern times. Right? You may remember the story about Eliyahu after his great triumph on Mount Carmel, and he defeats the priests of the Baal. And the very next day, his head is on a poster, most wanted by Jezebel. He runs away. He runs off to Beersheba, and he's in such despair that he leaves his servant, his Na'ar, in Beersheba. He says, you stay here, and I'm going to go. And he goes off into the desert, basically to commit suicide. My God doesn't let him do that, but that's the idea. Because once you leave Beersheba and you go south, that is not habitable anymore. We're going to see that that issue is one in modern times as well. So we have many stories in the Torah, certainly, and Tanakh as well, that take place in and around the Negev. Many of them have to do with water and with wells, right? So we have the stories of Abraham and Yitzchak and Avimelech and the Plishtim and Grar, right? Different Plishtim than the Plishtim we have in the book of Judges. That's a separate story, right? But they're always worrying about wells, digging wells, wells being stopped up, re-digging the same wells, because water is the only way you can survive here. And if you don't have that access to water, and everybody is dealing with this, whether it's the Avot, the patriarchs, or it's the Nabataeans, right? A couple of thousand years later, or it's the Zionists in the 1930s, everybody has to figure out the water story. Now, we hear about Abraham and Yitzchak in Beersheba. Where are they? Okay, so we have two candidates, neither of which are very good. Okay, we have this modern city of Beersheba today, which I'm sure some people here have visited. In Beersheba today, while it does have an old town, and it even has a site in that old town called Abraham's Well, Be'er Avraham, and this is what you're seeing over here on the right, it is most definitely not Be'er Avraham. It's a Byzantine well. It's about 1,500 years old as opposed to 4,000 years old. Okay, the Beersheba of today, at least as much as we have uncovered, does not go back to biblical times. It's very possible that we have built something over, you know, a place that was the original Beersheba. The other candidate is a place called Tel Sheva, okay? Tel Sheva, which is a Bedouin town, but right next to it, there's an archaeological site. We're going to look at it in a minute. It's a very interesting archaeological site, but it has no layer from the time of the Avot. Right? It does not have a layer from that time period. And so that's also not a good candidate for Beersheba. This picture on the left here, by the way, is this Be'er Avraham in about 100 years ago, a very important place, part of the Turkish conquest of Beersheba, but it is not the biblical Beersheba. So where is Avraham's Beersheba? That's a great question. We do not have an answer yet. Right? Before we come back to Tel Sheva, let's just take a look again at our tribal map, because that's always nice to know. So the Negev is basically the tribe of Judah, Yehuda, but we have this weird little enclave here of Shimon. And now Shimon is a strange tribe. If you remember from the blessings and somewhat curses of Jacob at the end of the book of Genesis, at the end of Bereshit, right? He is not pleased with Shimon and Levi, right? Remember, Shimon and Levi are responsible for the attack on Shechem, and Yaakov is very upset about that. And on his deathbed, says Shimon v'Levi achim heim klei chamas mechoroteim. They are brothers in anger and in violence. Achalkem b'Yaakov v'afitzem b'Yisrael. I'm going to divide them up. They shouldn't be together. You know those two kids that when they get together, they cause trouble? That's Shimon and Levi. We don't want them to be next to each other. Now, this prophecy is fulfilled differently for each of them. Levi's way it's fulfilled is that Levi doesn't get a tribal portion. Levi is scattered everywhere. So he's really Achalkem b'Yaakov. He's really divided up. He's spread out all over, and that kind of causes his powers to be used for good rather than for evil. Shimon has a different story. Shimon is kind of swallowed up by Yehuda, and then he moves. His Achalkem b'Yaakov is that he's in different places at different times. First, he's in Yehuda, and then he moves up north, and he comes back down south, right? He does not have a stable nachala. He's enclosed within Yehuda, and when Yehuda wants to kick him out, he gets kicked out. So if you follow the story in Tanakh, it's interesting. We're not going to go too deeply into it. But when you drive down south, you will get to an area that is called the local council of B'nai Shimon. Right? A lot of signs, a lot of local councils today in modern Israel go back to Tanakh names. So they're remembering this story of Shimon, who is swallowed up by Yehuda. Okay, so we mentioned water, right? Water is this worry that we always have to think about. How do you capture the water? How do you preserve the water? Okay, you can have wells, right, that go down to groundwater. So this picture here on the right is a picture from Tel Sheva that I mentioned to you before, this really great archaeological site to the east of Be'er Sheva. It's an amazing well. It goes down dozens of meters deep, thousands of years old, and it's incredible how they were able to have that technology. It goes down very deep till it reaches groundwater. So you do have wells, but you also have cisterns, right? Cisterns are to collect rainwater. When you have rain and you have flash floods that we're going to see in a minute, you want to make sure you can collect as much water as you can so that you'll have it for the future. You'll also have the runoffs. Tel Sheva also has a water system that's based on the runoffs from the local riverbeds. Okay? The guys who are amazing at collecting water, the classics are the Nabataeans. I'm going to talk about them in a minute. People from 2,000 years ago, and their cisterns are around the Negev. And this is one of their cisterns over here on the left. Okay. Flash floods, right? These pictures of flash floods are incredible. Anybody who, there are people who actually go out, they hear about that it's going to be raining higher up. If it rains, you know, in Jerusalem or in the mountains of Yehuda, then there'll be a flash flood in the Negev. And there are people who actually go out and will sit for hours just to see this incredible sight, which is what you're seeing here. This is from Nachal Tzin, if I'm remembering correctly, right? We hear about this in Tehillim, Ka'afikim ba-Negev, as water channels in the Negev. What happens? It rains high up in the mountains of Jerusalem or even, you know, further south. And that rain, of course, is going to flow to the lowest place, which is the Dead Sea or the Jordan Valley. So it starts to flow and it starts to flow and it starts to flow. And the afikim, the little channels, join together until you have this mighty rushing flood that's over in a few minutes. Now, in those few minutes, it can cause great harm, terrible destruction. We had an awful story a few years ago about kids who were caught in a flash flood and swept away and killed. Okay, so you have to be very, very, very cautious about flash floods. But if you are smart enough to figure out where the root of the flood goes, you can create cisterns and water channels and aqueducts to trap that water, and then you'll have water for the future. And we see this in various places in various time periods in the Negev, and it really is something that is very powerful and very impressive. So let's talk for a minute about Tel Sheva that I mentioned before. Okay, the border in biblical times, in Roman times, pretty much everything till modern times. Let's just go back for 1 minute to our map, right? The border is essentially this line of Be'er Sheva to Arad. Okay, that's about as low as you can go and have habitable land. Okay, so it's also the border in a political sense, meaning whoever is in charge wants to protect these areas and to have fortresses there. Okay, so in Tel Sheva, which is on this line, you have an amazing administrative town. Okay, that goes back to the time of Chizkiyahu, of Hezekiah, meaning 7th century before the Common Era. There are earlier layers, but that's when it's really built up. It's a very, very well-planned town with a huge water system. It's at the confluence of two riverbeds, okay, Nachal Chevron and Nachal Be'er Sheva, so that when these flash floods come, the water is directed, goes into the riverbeds and is directed into the water system. It's very, very, and that the water system is what you're seeing here on the right. Okay. It's a well-planned town. It had storehouses. This is the pictures that you're seeing here. It also seems to have been a cultic site, right? We hear in Tanakh and Nevi'im, the prophets talk about places where there was worship outside of Jerusalem, right? Be'er Sheva is one of those places. And we actually found, when they excavated here, they found an altar, a complete and perfect altar, except that it had been dismantled, right? With the horns, it had been taken apart and put into the basement of a house. Why? We'll answer that when we look at our next site, which is on the same line, right? Just go to the east and you have Arad. Okay, now Arad, Tel Arad, today there's a modern city of Arad that's a couple of kilometers right outside of the Tell. But the Tell is a fascinating place because it's two layers. It was a very large, thriving Canaanite city, okay, from about 3,000, 3,500 years ago. And then that city is abandoned. And then in Israelite times, already from the time of King Solomon, meaning 3,000 years ago, you have a fortress, not a full city, but a fortress. Okay, the Canaanite city goes back further, actually. There's about 1,000 years gap between the two cities. And from the time of King Solomon until the destruction of the first temple, you have this fortress that's added to, that's changed by various kings. Okay, and that's what you can see here on the top is this Israelite fortress because we're on the border. They also have a water system, not quite as impressive as the one in Tel Sheva. But what they have that is even more astounding than the altar in Tel Sheva is that when they excavated in this fortress, underneath the ground, they discovered an entire temple, a little temple, a mini temple, but a temple nonetheless. Okay, a temple that had a perfect altar, whose dimensions were 5 amot by 5 amot by 3 amot, meaning the exact dimensions of the altar in the Mishkan, in the tabernacle in the desert. Okay, it's made out of field stones, not hewn stones like the one in Beersheba. It's exactly the way you're supposed to make it. And then further in from this altar, which was intact, it hadn't been taken apart, is this area of a temple which has a few different sections. It has a Mizbeach HaKtoret, two of them actually, incense altars. And then when you go further in, it has these monuments, these kind of gods that are here. So you have an outside courtyard with an altar, you have an inner sanctuary, the holy, and you have an even more inner sanctuary, a holy of holies. It's really a mini copy of the temple in Jerusalem with a little idolatry thrown in, right? These two matzevot. Now, what's going on? Number one, why is this buried? And why is the altar in Tel Sheva buried? And number two, why is it here in the first place? So why is it buried is very easy to explain, right? In the time of King Chizkiyahu Hezekiah, and again, in the time of his great-grandson, Yoshiyahu, Josiah, there are religious reforms. Okay? And part of the religious reform is to get rid of idolatry, but part of the religious reform is to get rid of any outside temples. There's supposed to be one temple, one God, one temple. People didn't listen to that. So the king's supervisors go out to various places, and they come and they knock at the gates of the city. Hello, got any temples here? Got any altars here? Oh, you do? Okay, we'll be back in a month to make sure it's gone. Okay. Now the people of the town are not going to set an altar on fire. They are not going to bulldoze a temple because it's holy to them. So what do? They put it in what we would call today Geniza. They cover it up. Okay. Now in Tel Sheva, they actually dismantled the altar, but they put it in a basement. In Arad, they really just covered the entire thing up so that when the king's men come back, they'll say, oh no, it's not here anymore, but it's buried underground intact for us to see. And it's incredible because it really is a snapshot of how people worshiped 2,700 years ago. Now, why are they making these things? Because everybody wants a local temple. And what I want you to imagine is the soldiers who are stationed out here in Tel Arad, which is very far from everything, right? It's very far away. And they're lonely and they're nervous and they're scared and it's frightening out here. And they can't get to the temple in Jerusalem because the temple in Jerusalem is far away. So they make their own temple, which is not necessarily an idolatrous temple, by the way. It's a syncretism. It's a combination, right? And then they have to destroy it. But for us to find it, it's an unbelievable thing. So that's in Tel Arad. Now let's leap forward from Tanakh times to Second Temple and a little bit afterwards. And we have these guys called the Nabataeans. Now the Nabataeans are very interesting. We have monuments that they left behind, but we don't have texts. Either they didn't have any kind of a literature or we haven't found it yet. Okay. We know about them through Josephus and we know about them through their archaeology. They may or may not be connected to the Edomites, right? Edom on the other side of the Jordan River. We know that Herod is an Edomite and he's connected to the Nabataeans as well, and their gods are similar. And it's very possible that the Nabataeans are just kind of an evolution of the Edomites. They start out as a nomadic people. They make their living by running caravans and a spice route that comes from the Negev, right, and goes out towards the desert and out towards Saudi Arabia. They're able to do this, to go through this very forbidding landscape, because they understand how to get water, how to save water, how to get water, how to store up water for the future, right? Eventually, they become not completely nomadic and they build cities. The most famous one, of course, is Petra, as you can see on the map over here, Petra on the other side of the Jordan, which is their most impressive city, but they also build cities in the Negev. Avdat, which is the picture that you see here on the right, Mamshit, and others, and they are able to do this because they are able to get to the water. So the Nabataeans are very interesting, disappeared from the world, but their spice route is now part of a United Nations World Heritage Center and World Heritage Sites, and they're very, very interesting. Now, in the Middle Ages, you have Jews and you have Christians who live in the Western Negev, okay? Again, this northern area that's more or less habitable, okay? And you have a community called Ma'on, right, which is in the western, northwestern Negev. Today it's near Kibbutz Nirim that we're going to talk about when we talk about modern times, okay? And there's an amazing, astounding mosaic floor that was discovered there. This is from the 6th century. It was found in the 50s because they were doing road construction, and they just stumbled on this perfect, intact, gorgeous mosaic floor from a synagogue. They also found a church, and very similar, by the way, very similar mosaics. How many mosaic artists were living in the Western Negev? Probably one guy. And you don't turn down a commission. So if the church hires you, you take that. And if the synagogue hires you, you take that, because the art is more or less the same. So I'll just look at these animals for another minute because they're so beautiful. But we're going to jump forward from Byzantine times, right? From 6th century or so of the Common Era. We're going to jump forward to modern times and to the Jewish settlement in the Negev, which is a very important part of our story. Okay, so we have this very fascinating phenomenon, which is that when the Jews start to come back to the land with the beginnings of Zionism in the 1880s, right? 1882, first Aliyah, 1904, second Aliyah, they're buying whatever land they can get. Now, what land can they get? And this is what you see on this map here. This is a map already from 1944, so it has stuff from the Negev, but you can see it's pretty sparse. What's the major areas of settlement? It's a nice N shape. Goes more or less up the coast, across the Jezreel Valley, and up in the Eastern Galilee. Now, why are they settling here? The Eastern Galilee, I don't have such a great answer for you, but the coast and the Jezreel Valley, this is land that is trash. Nobody wants this land. I just did a virtual tour about the Mamluks, right? The guys who get rid of the Crusaders in the 13th century. There's a tour guide and educator named Hagi Amitzor who did a great YouTube lecture called How Baibars Helped Write the Shulchan Aruch, right? Baibars was the Mamluk conqueror who got rid of the Crusaders, and he develops the area of Tzfat, and that makes it very inviting for the Jews when they come in the 15th and the 16th century. But the other thing he does, and this is very important, is he destroys the coast. He destroys the beautiful coastal cities of Akko and Caesarea and Jaffa and Ashkelon, because he doesn't want the Crusaders to come back. So these areas become swampy and uncared for, and nobody wants them. And when the Jews come with ready cash at the end of the 19th and the early 20th century, and they say, we want to buy land, the absentee landlords in Beirut and in Damascus are more than happy to sell them this land at inflated prices. Same thing for the Jezreel Valley, a place that had been very fertile, was neglected, absentee landlords, swamps, mosquitoes, malaria, and the Jews are able to buy this. Okay, so this is where they settle. What's neglected? the area of the mountains, when we talked about Gush Etzion and Hebron last time, and the Negev. Now, the Negev is neglected not because people are living there like they are in the mountains, but because it's too hard to live here. And we can't do this. It's hard enough for us to live in these places. Think about the early travails of these first communities. This is even harder, okay? So they don't really settle in the Negev. Now, what is there in the Negev? There's Be'er Sheva, right? And that's the picture you see here on the right. Be'er Sheva is an old town, but it's also a very new town. The Turks build it mid-19th century. The Turks build it mostly so they can control the Bedouin. It's conquered by the British in World War I, right? October 1917, very, very famous charge of the Australian and the New Zealand light horsemen at the end of October, October 31st, 1917. It's conquered by the British, but it has very, very few Jews, okay? And there's very little in the Negev that is owned by Jews, that is built up by Jews. There's really not much happening there. And the Jews understand that if they want to have this land given to them in any future partition, and we're going to see the pictures of the maps of partition in a few minutes, they're going to have to start settling there. But there are a lot of obstacles in the way, because these places are hard to settle, as well as the fact that the British are not really allowing too much settlement. So they start out with what's called Choma u'Migdal, right? Tower and stockade settlements. This was a very Jewish, the Jewish brain finds ways around things. The British don't allow new land purchase, new settlement. We're going to follow this old Turkish law, which basically says that if there is a wall and a tower that is standing, then that's considered a settlement and you can't kick us out. And what the Jews would do is they would go places. I was just up north. I was just in a place called Hanita, up by the border with Lebanon. You show up with a bunch of young people with some materials in the middle of the night. You build a wall, you build a tower. And when the British officer comes by the next morning, oh, well, we have a settlement here. So they do that in various areas of the country. We're going to see it more in the Negev, but the first one is a place called Negba. Now, Negba is not south at all. Okay? It's near Kiryat Gat of today, but it's a beginning, but they understand they need to branch out. So where did they branch out? They branch out to something called Mitzpim. Mitzpim are not really settlements. Mitzpeh is kind of like a lookout point. The conditions are very difficult. The idea is to create a small community with 10 to 12 workers with a courtyard. And what they're going to do is they're going to do two things. They're testing two things. They're testing the British. Can we stay here and they won't kick us out? What's going to be, right? Can we move further in our conquest of the land? And they're also testing the land. What's the climate like? What's the water like? Is there opportunities for agriculture, right? The Keren Kayamet, the JNF, buys whatever land they can, whether or not it's good land. And so you have to see what you can do with it. Now, these first three mitzpim are kind of in a triangle around the city of Be'er Sheva, Gvulot, Revivim, Beit Eshel. Very difficult conditions, not easy, but these are very idealistic young people, right? And they go out to settle in these areas, but any kind of further settlement is going to need water. Okay. And again, we come back to our same water question. How are we going to provide water for these places so that we can have agriculture, so that people can live, so that it's sustainable? So they call in this guy, this fellow, this baldy here on the left, whose name is Simcha Blass. He's a water engineer. Eventually, he works for Mikorot, for the water company. And he comes up with an early idea of what we call the national water carrier, bringing water from the north down south. That does eventually happen, but it doesn't happen in the 1940s because it's just not really possible at that time. We don't have the technology. We don't have the permission to do it. So what do? They discover that there is a lot of water. There are actually natural water sources, underground water sources, near a place called Niram, okay? And what they do is they lay two pipelines, okay? One going all the way out here to the south and west, and one going out to the south and east, bringing water, okay? 1946, they lay 220 kilometers of pipes. Where do the pipes come from, by the way? They come from London, where they were used during World War II, during the time of the Blitz, to put out fires. And we got them cheap, I guess, secondhand. And they lay these lines, and this is literally the lifeline for the Negev, right? Because once you have water, then you can have life, then you can have community. communities. And we have a great poem by the national poet of the time, Natan Alterman. Natan Alterman was a very interesting poet. He wrote a lot of very deep, very dense poetry, but he also wrote a weekly, like a current events kind of column that was much lighter and was about, you know, what was happening in the country. And he wrote this concerto for a pipe, Concerto Latsinor, right? And I'll read you the last part of it. Lo pam nichliku deot chacham vapeti et ha historia mi ose lemi ha yitaron. Not very often, the wise and the foolish argue. Who makes history? Who has the advantage? Echad machriz osim otaha kabinetim. One says it's the cabinets, the governments that do it. Sheni shar hapkidot. No. It's the bureaucracy. It's the little people. They're the ones who do it. Shlishi toen haho. And the third one says, what are you talking about? It's the money. Echad sach hanasi. One says it's the president. Echad sacha senator. Another says it's the senator. Nachon. You're all right, but it might turn out that in the end, what's going to be clear is od sheota ose asa ha-instellator asher kiven sinor imberes lamidbar. Who's really making history? The instellator, the plumber who pointed a pipe with water, with a faucet towards the desert. So Natan Alterman chips in with his two cents about what is going to make settlement in the Negev. And indeed, once these water pipes are laid, and if you remember our map of the water pipes, okay, now look at the map of the new settlements. It's not accidental. It's on purpose. Okay? And there is a very crazy and unprecedented operation. Okay? October 1946, they decide that they are going to put up overnight settlements, but not one, not two, 11. Okay? These are known as the 11 points in the Negev. They're very famous. They're going to put them up overnight, 11 new communities. Now, when I say community, do not imagine, I don't know, you know, Efrat or Brooklyn. This is a community right over here. This is a picture of Nirim. Here's Nirim over here. Remember, we mentioned it before where the Maon Synagogue is. Here's Nirim. This is Nirim when it was first put up. So when we say community, it's a very broad definition of community. Okay. It's a wall. It's a few buildings, right? It's a communal dining room. But it's enough. It's something. Now, they decide they're going to do this all at once, take the British by surprise, because, of course, they're not allowed to do this. And what's the one time that this would never be expected? Okay, you might be able to guess from the fact that it's taking place in October. They decide to do it on Motzei Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur is over, and they are going to go out and set up these 11 communities, which, of course, the British do not expect anything happening right after Yom Kippur. So what they do, it's very well planned. They have 11 small groups, okay? Each group has 25 boys and 5 girls in it, a little bit uneven in the gender, okay? They don't know their destination. They're taken before Yom Kippur to a place not so far away with supplies, okay? And then they go immediately. Yom Kippur is over the night between October 5th and October 6th, 1946, excuse me. And they set up these 11 places. And the next day, the headline in the newspaper, Yishuvei HaNegev Nigalu Mibididutam. The communities of the Negev have been redeemed from their loneliness. And this was just a crazy, crazy, audacious, but very important plan. Now, what's the result of all of this, of the Choma Migdal, the tower and stockade, of the Mitzpim, of the water pipe? Okay, take a look at the two maps. In 1937, right, the British sit down and create a partition plan, something called the Peel Commission. It's not actually put into action, but the Jews have access. They are listening in to the plan in real time as the British are meeting in the ballroom of the Palace Hotel that the Jews have bugged, that the Haganah has bugged, and they hear about what's happening. And this is the map, okay? Our purple over here, blue, purple, whatever you want to call it. This is the Jewish land, which of course is following our basic N shape, right? Okay? The pink is what's given to the Arabs. It's also international Jerusalem. But the Arabs get all of the area of the mountains, Judea and Samaria, and all of the area of the Negev. And this is what pushes the yeshuv, the Jewish communities, to understand that they have to create facts on the ground, because that's the only way that they're going to make a difference. And when the United Nations Commission shows up 10 years later, The Arabs ignore them because the Arabs don't want to accept anything more than 100%. And the Jews wine and dine them, and they take them to see these new communities. Look, look, we've made the desert bloom. And the UN is actually very impressed. And they go home and they create this partition plan, which is the one we are all familiar with, where we still get this area on the coast. The Galilee is divided up. Hey, we still don't get the mountains, but we get almost the entire Negev. And that's a huge, huge difference. Now, ultimately, it doesn't make a difference in the plan, doesn't make a difference because the battle, the War of Independence breaks out, and whatever we win is what we keep. But the communities make a difference because the communities stop the onslaught, stop the advance of the Egyptian army, which is what we're going to see now. War breaks out right after partition is voted on. Just important to understand, right? There are two stages to the War of Independence from November 30th, from the day after the United Nations vote until May 14th. The war is a local war, what some people call a civil war, right? Local Arabs, they're supported by the Arabs countries on the outside, but the Arab countries can't invade because the British are still here. Once the British leave and Israel declares a state, May 14th, May 15th, the Arab armies can invade, okay? Egypt, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, et cetera, okay? But that can only happen in May. So before that, it's much more kind of localized attacks, attacks on the roads, and the Negev is very isolated, okay? And one of the ways to attack, one of the most effective ways to attack, you guessed it, is the water, right? We have this water pipeline, this lifeline. It's not so hard to disrupt it. You send out one guy in the middle of the night to cut the line. That's it, right? Those communities that are past the cut don't get water. So part of the job of the Haganah, of the Palmach, really, the elite unit of the Haganah, is to be watching this water pipe all the time and to be seeing where there are problems and where it might be cut, because this sabotage is a very, very big deal. The Negev is very much on the front lines. The Arabs understand that they need to get the Jews out of here in order that the advance of the Egyptian army can continue. This is a sign that was up in the dining room of Kibbutz Nirim, that we're going to tell their story in a minute, but it's an important sign. It was transformed into a memorial. Lo hatank yinatzeach ki'im ha'adam. It's not the tank that will win the battles, but the human being. And this became one of the slogans, by the way, of the tank corps. And it's the people, and it's the resilience and the resistance of the people in the communities that's going to save us. And that's what we're going to see. So May 15th, the Arab armies attack. And what's important for our story, all the parts are important, but what's important for our story are the Egyptian attacks, right? The Egyptians are coming on two major lines. They're coming up from the mountains through Beersheba. They're going to come towards Gush Etzion, coming towards Jerusalem. But what's important for our story is they're also coming up on the coast with their goal, of course, to be Tel Aviv, right? But what they're going to discover along the way is these small communities that you would think would be completely overwhelmed by the military might of the Egyptians, right? Take a look at the numbers here. 11,000 troops making their way, and these are communities with a couple of dozen people. And yet, they are pushed back at every turn. Okay, so the very first place is Nirim. Okay, just go back for 1 second where Nirim is, right? See Nirim, you can understand why it's the very first stop. May 15th, the Egyptian army is coming up. Nirim, of course, is incredibly outnumbered by the Egyptians, but they push back and they give the Egyptians the impression that there's much more power here than there really is. In fact, the Egyptians even believe that there are towers controlled by electricity that come up and down, that they're swallowed up in the ground. Hey, they put up signs that there are mines here. There are no mines. They shoot wherever they can. And somehow they are able to hold out. Eight are killed. We'll see in a minute, but they're able to hold out and the Egyptians have to go a different route. Now, this is the memorial here. The kibbutz is no longer in the same place. It was moved somewhat, but on the grounds of the original kibbutz, there's a memorial. to the battle here, to the soldiers who died here, soldiers, members of the kibbutz. And here's again, Lo HaTanki Natzeach Ki Im HaAdam. Here it is again, bigger. And these are the eight soldiers that are killed here. By the way, one of them, a woman, Rivka Zaltzman, David Alon, Ephraim Ori, Betzalel Eitan, Giora Alter, Rivka Zaltzman, Yosef Lev, Tzvi Laser, and Yitzhak Friedlander. Giora Alter, I'll just give you one example. There are so many. Giora Alter is born in Vienna in 1925. So he's very young. He's 23 years old. They moved to France. The family moves to France to escape the Nazis. His parents stay in France. He comes to Israel. We have his letters that he wrote to his mother saying, don't worry, this is where we should be. This is where Jews should be. And the kibbutz, the Egyptians are turned back. The kibbutz holds out for another 6 months underground. Okay, everything is destroyed. After the war is over, they rebuild further north. But the Egyptians move on. They have to skirt Kibbutz Nirim. And the next place they get to is Yad Mordechai. And Yad Mordechai, named after fighter of the Warsaw Ghetto, the leader of the Warsaw Ghetto revolt, Mordechai Anilevich. Here's Abba Kovner, one of the fighters. He was a partisan who fought in the Vilna Ghetto uprising. These guys are battle scarred, right? They've been through a lot. And they managed to hold off the Egyptians, this tiny force. They hold off the Egyptians for five full days. And again, the Egyptians have to go around. Now, all of this has an enormous effect. Number one, it saves many lives, because instead of going through Jewish communities where they see it's not going to be easy, they go through sympathetic Arab communities. So Jewish lives are saved. Not only that, but by the time they get near Ashdod, right, and Israel manages to take two of the four planes that they have bought secondhand from Czechoslovakia that are garbage, but they manage to fly them over the Egyptian army is completely spooked. They're like, oh my God, they have planes, they have an air force, they're going to bomb us. We don't have any of those capabilities, but they don't know that. And they turn around. And that's why today, right outside of Ashdod, there's a bridge. It's called Gesher Ad Halom, the bridge till here, right? And I didn't remember if I had put a picture in. And that's the point where the Egyptian army turns back. So instead of continuing on to Tel Aviv, where the road was basically open to them, they could have totally taken Tel Aviv. They don't, because all of this resistance freaks them out. And they turn back. So these kibbutzim have an enormous role in saving the rest of Israel. Now, the war is over. What happens next? So here's Ben-Gurion, right? The George Washington of Israel, one of the founding fathers. Obviously, he spends a lot of time in Tel Aviv. He spends time in Jerusalem. He's the first prime minister, but his heart is in the Negev. And in fact, he writes about who is the first Jewish immigrant? Who is the first person who comes to the land of Israel? Abraham. Where does he go? He goes to the Negev. Everyone's got to go to the Negev, right? That's his idea. And if you go to his home in Stable Care, because he didn't only talk the talk, he walked the walk as well. And when he leaves being prime minister, he goes and he becomes a member of Kibbutz Stable Care, and he actually insists on working. You get the feeling that they're not like so excited about this, because, you know, they have to deal with his security detail and everything else, but they let him become a member of the kibbutz. And he really believes that the Negev is the story of the future. And if you go today to Kibbutz Stable Care, there's a midrashah there, there's a school there, and there's a museum about Ben-Gurion, with all these wonderful quotes. And one of them you have here, right? Sab kiyumash ha-medina Israel hula hadrim. The state of Israel to exist must go south. And he writes a lot about the Negev. One of the things he writes is that nobody should come here expecting to enjoy what has been built already. You have to go and you have to build new things. And part of that story is going to the Negev. Now, he is so connected to the Negev that he insists that when he dies, he doesn't want to be buried on Mount Herzl. He doesn't want to be buried in the pantheon of great leaders. Quite a lot of great leaders didn't want to be buried in the pantheon. And he wants to be buried in Stable Care. And he gets some pretty nice real estate overlooking the Nachal Tzin, that beautiful view that we saw at the beginning. So here's David Ben-Gurion's grave and his wife, Paula Ben-Gurion, here together. And he really believed in the Negev as the future of the state of Israel. Now, part of that story is the story of the development towns. Some of you may have been in the course where we talked about the great Aliyah of the late 40s of the early 50s, right? This huge, huge influx of immigrants, thousands coming in every month. Where are they going to go? A, where are they going to go? Where are they going to live? B, what are they going to eat? Because the state of Israel in the early years doesn't have a lot of resources. So where are they going to go? What are they going to eat? What are they going to work in, right? How are we going to protect our borders? So let's solve all those problems at once by building what are called development towns, which many people have pointed out that that is somewhat of an oxymoron because for many years they were not particularly developed. Okay? But build these towns in the south, Ofakim, in 1955, Netivot in 1956, Yerucham, where's Yerucham, 1951, Dimona, where our nuclear reactor is not located, our non-nuclear reactor is located, let's say it that way, okay, in 1955, build these towns, okay, and send the new immigrants to there, right? And the idea is to have an urban center, right? Ofakim is a good example, and around it are all kinds of smaller communities and farms, and you'll grow your own food, and it'll be fabulous, and you'll love it. You were a lawyer in Tunisia, so you'll be a farmer here. You were a banker in Morocco, great, you're going to raise chickens. It's going to be wonderful. You're going to love it. Naturally, not everybody loved it, but it was the solution for the time. It gave a home to people. There weren't refugee camps forever. Part of the issues were that who were the people who were sent here? Not the Ashkenazi immigrants to a great extent, not the ones who came after the Holocaust, but the Moroccans and the Tunisians and the Libyans, and these are the guys who are sent down here. So there definitely was racism going on here. But on the other hand, they did create a place, a home for everyone. And Israel is dealing with the aftermath of that. And by the way, many of these towns are beginning to thrive today, but a lot of it because new populations came in. It's a very complicated story. Now, another population that's an important population in the Negev is the Bedouin, okay? The Bedouin community there are 200,000 Bedouin in the Negev. It's the largest Bedouin community in Israel. The Bedouin is certainly in their traditional way of life are nomads. Governments don't like nomads. The Turks didn't like it. The British didn't like it. And Israel doesn't like it either. And you want to contain nomads. You want to be able to count people. You want to be able to collect taxes. You want their kids to go to school. So what Israel did in the 60s through the 80s is they created 7 Bedouin towns, okay, where the Bedouin are supposed to live. Now, some Bedouin did move there and live there, and others did not. And anytime you drive down to the Negev, you can see all kinds of unauthorized, off-the-grid, unmapped Bedouin townships that kind of just sprang up out of nowhere and don't have resources and are not great, right? It's not a great situation. But the towns that are created, Rahat is the largest one. It has a big industrial zone. It's got 70,000 people living in it. Tel Sheva, Segev Shalom, I always forget one or two. Hura, Lakia. All right, how many do we have here? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Rijat. Let me see if I can find them. And Aroer. Why am I having trouble finding? All right, sorry. I'm not finding them. Arara is one of them. And Ksefa. Ksefa, did we find Ksefa? If you find it for yourself. Okay, but they're all, here we go. Okay, safe. All right. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. 7 Bedouin townships. And the idea is to contain them in these places, but like I said, it doesn't always work. But some of these places are thriving, some are not. Rahat is a very interesting example. And we'll take a look at the industrial zone in a minute. What's interesting with the Bedouin is that Israel has a very complicated relationship with the Bedouin. Bedouin can volunteer for the army. Some of them serve in the army, as many of them as trackers, as gashashim, because they know the land very intimately, certainly the ones who are brought up as nomads. But sometimes we have an antagonistic relationship with the Bedouin. It behooves Israel to stay on the good side of the Bedouin because they also have ties to the Palestinian Arabs, and we want them to be on our side more. Some of the very interesting new initiatives in the Bedouin community both Bedouin alone, as well as working with Jews. There are new initiatives for employment. So I mentioned the industrial center in Rahat. This is a picture of one of the biggest company in the industrial zone, and that's SodaStream. Some of you may be familiar with the story of SodaStream. SodaStream is an Israeli company that was set up in right outside Ma'ale Adumim. Right, not far from Jerusalem, an area over the Green Line, hiring Israeli Jews, Israeli Arabs, and Palestinian Arabs. And it was really, I don't know if it was, everybody sitting down and singing together, but it was coexistence in the sense of employment for all sorts of people. And BDS, boycott, divestment, and sanction, push them out. Oh, you're a company in Judea and Samaria. We're going to boycott you. Nobody should buy from Soda and SodaStream, blah, 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 all their garbage, and basically put all these people out of work. But the founder of SodaStream was not daunted. And instead, he moved his company to Rahat, to this Bedouin town, where again, he has a very diverse mixture of employees. And that's the picture that you see here on the right. So you have combinations of Jews and Bedouin working together. You also have very interesting initiatives from the women. Now, if you think about it, traditional society, who has the most to lose in traditional society? Women. Right? Women, because the women in traditional societies tend to be stuck at home. And there are women in the Bedouin community who want to continue their traditional way of life, but want to have more opportunities. And there are all kinds of interesting initiatives, education and job opportunities. So one of them, this is the picture here on the left, is in Laqia, and it's a cooperative of women who are weavers and embroidery, and they do all this traditional work. And they're able to work from home, but they're able to make a living as well. And it became a tourist attraction and people come. And so that's another interesting world that the Bedouin are in today. And finally, there are Israeli researchers who understand that the Bedouin have a deep connection to the environment and to the land because they're so tied to the land. And so they've created initiatives that take advantage of the Bedouin knowledge of the land. So whether it's medicinal plants, right, and understanding traditional medicine and how to grow these plants and how to use them for medicine, or there's another community called Wadi Atir, which is an organic farm, right? Again, taking the knowledge, the traditional knowledge that the Bedouin have about the land, applying it to modern methods and benefiting both communities. So there is a lot of wonderful stuff going on there. Okay, forests, a little bit about the nature, about the forests. There are two forests together, okay? The Yatir Forest and the Lahav Forest. The Lahav Forest was founded already in 1952, the Yatir Forest in 1964. So both of them before 67. So they are inside the Green Line. Together, they are the largest forest in Israel. Okay? They're actually on the Green Line. The trees were planted up to the border, the 67 border. It's the largest forest in Israel, despite the fact that it's in the Negev, in this very, very, dry place. And there have been fascinating studies that have been done by the Weizmann Institute, a professor named Danya Kier, who discovered, right, who studied the whole story of carbon dioxide, right, and how trees release, store carbon and release oxygen. And what he found, first of all, there are 4 million trees in these forests, is the more trees there are, of course, the less global warming, right? The more oxygen that's released, the more carbon that's stored. This is all very good for the environment. But what he discovered is that trees in a desert environment store carbon more efficiently than trees in a non-desert environment. So you get more bang for your buck in forests that are planted in deserts than in other places. And it causes less global warming. So that's really a fascinating thing. And the studies are done here in these two forests in the Negev, Yar Yatir and Yar Lahav. They are more carbon efficient. Okay? Now in Yar Yatir, they found all kinds of other things, ancient settlement, ancient installations. You're seeing a wine press here. You also have an ancient synagogue in Yatir right, over here. It's a synagogue that actually has a hideout tunnel underground. It was part of the Bar Kokhba revolt, and there's an underground cave system where the rebels would hide out. We have wine presses, oil presses. We even have this installation over here on the left, which looks like an olive press, right? This is the what's called the yam, where you put your olives in the place where the water is. The water is just there because it was rainy. And then you have a beam that you attach to the middle and a large round stone, and you crush your olives. We see these in lots of places, but the suggestion is that this is not for olives, but it's actually for barley, because barley was grown in these areas, because barley is a very hardy crop and it can survive even in areas that don't have a lot of water. And we think that this is a barley crushing installation. So that's just a fascinating thing that was discovered from ancient times in the Etir forest. Because the Negev is a place that's very hard to grow things, right? Challenge creates innovation. And that's why the Negev is in some ways Israel's center for experimental agriculture, right? And research and development and new crops and new ways of growing crops and new irrigation methodology, right? Drip irrigation, things like that. Arid environments are a challenge, and you can conquer that challenge and create incredible, incredible agriculture. So this is a picture from a great place in the Negev. Some people may have been there, called the Salad Trail. It's actually not a farm that exists to sell its produce. It's a farm that exists as a tourism farm. It's meant for people to come, birthright groups come here to show Israeli agricultural innovation and to taste, literally to taste the fruits of its success. So that's very cool. There's also some interesting animals that are raised in the Negev. There's an ostrich farm. Hey, this is a couple, Sophia and Mike Van Harbenbroek. They were fascinated by ostriches. The problem was there were no ostriches in the land of Israel. So how could you raise ostriches? They had to come from South Africa. South Africa did not allow you to import baby ostriches or ostrich eggs. So they basically smuggled out eggs in their suitcases and the eggs started to hatch on the plane. And today they have an ostrich farm in the Negev. And today they don't actually sell the meat or the eggs. It's more of a tourist farm, but it's kind of a neat place to discover. And finally, Be'er Sheva. Anybody who's gone to Be'er Sheva in the last 10, 15 years and remembers going there in the 70s, you know, the first thing you say when you drive in is, wow, it sure doesn't look like it used to look, right? Be'er Sheva is the eighth most populous city in the country. It's the second largest in area. It's definitely the largest in the Negev. Today, there are about more than 200,000 residents of Be'er Sheva. Out of that, about 10% Arabs, mostly Bedouin. My favorite statistic about Be'er Sheva is it has more chess grandmasters per capita than any other city in the world. Why? Because of the huge Russian Jewish immigration here in the 80s and the 90s. This was a city that was able to really take in so many of the Russian immigrants. So there are a lot of chess grandmasters. Today, Be'er Sheva is growing, and it has new parks and museums and a high-tech center. The hospital, which you see here on the bottom, right? Soroka Hospital. It's the third largest hospital in Israel. It is the only hospital in the Negev, which is crazy. But because of that, it has the most births of any hospital in the country, 17,000 births per year because of this large Bedouin population and a large Orthodox population, lots of babies born in Soroka. And of course, to come back to Ben-Gurion, right? Ben-Gurion had this vision for the Negev, and the university in Be'er Sheva is named for him, Ben-Gurion University. And a lot of what happens here is research into agriculture, into solar energy, into all sorts of amazing technologies that work here in the Negev. So Ben-Gurion's vision realized, and among other places, in the university that is named for him. So let's take a look at questions that we have. Oh, so the titles here are just just the credits from people in Wikipedia, that's all. People get killed by flash floods, definitely is very true. That's why I spoke about the tragedy a few years ago. Altar in the basement like conversos. No, the idea is not that they continue, at least as far as we understand, is not that they continued to use it because it was dismantled, but rather that they saw it as holy and they could not part with it. They couldn't destroy it, and therefore they put it into Geniza. Hey, what is the linear dimension of the Amot of the horned altars? Okay, so it's cubits, is that the word that I want, right? So a cubit is about a foot and a half, right? So do the math, 5 amot is about 8 feet? I'm not doing the math right, but you guys can do it better. 5 amot by 5 amot by 3 amot. It's not very big, right? It's definitely not very big, but that's the dimensions of what it was in the tabernacle. Okay, burying it again. It not that it was kept on being used, but it's just not destroyed. Why? What documentary evidence is there that it was buried? Look at Tanakh. Tanakh talks all about going out and getting rid of these things, right? And here they are. They're not gotten rid of. We see them. They are here, right? So I think that is as close documentary evidence as you can get. Yeah, sneaking across into Petra was very, very dangerous. It was definitely something that was like a very glamorous thing to do for young people in the 50s and the 60s. There was even a song about it that was banned from Israel radio, Hasela Adom, the Red Rock, because they banned it because they said it glamorized this and it was very dangerous and you shouldn't do it. But yes, definitely people did. Simcha Blass, I believe, was one of the inventors of drip irrigation. I don't think he's the only one, but yes. Facts on the ground. Yes, that's true. Bedouin is a complicated story and Hilltop Youth. Correct. Regavim is a very interesting organization. Definitely worth looking into. And yes, they are very much involved in the story of the Bedouin and illegal immigration. Yatir Winery. Yes, a lot of good wineries. There's also, they've discovered that you can actually grow grapes very well in a very deprived environment. Grapes do well when they have to be pushed to survive, like Jews. Avishai Teicher is just the photographer. Photographers and Wikipedia, that's all. And the Army, thank you. I was going to mention that and I forgot, right? The Army is moving out of their very prime real estate in central Israel, which is ridiculous that they hold on to it, and they are moving down to the Negev. There's an enormous army base, Ir HaBahadim, right outside of Yerucham. They're building up Yerucham. And this is also, by the way, something that is going to bring a lot of these places out of their economic depression. Already, Ir HaBahadim has done wonderful things for Yerucham real estate, because now you have all these high army officers who need a place to live, and they're going to buy down in Yerucham, down in Dimona, because it's very close by. So yes, 100%, the Army is trying to move as much as possible out of the center and down to the Negev. I translated some postdoc research for the university, modern development and medicine. Yes, amazing stuff. Amazing, amazing stuff. Scholarly disputes. Yes, exactly. I don't have a more exact number, but you could definitely Google it and find many articles that are very, very technical. I'm not so big on it, but I'm sure a lot of people are interested in the dimensions of the amot. The Gemara already talks about different kinds of amot, right? An amah mitzrit, an amah Israel. Right? There's different kinds of amot. Thank you, everyone. Did I miss any comments? I don't think so. So I will just remind you all, yes, and the train is also a very important step forward. I will remind you all that I am not teaching next week. I have another commitment, but after that, we will continue with our series.
Thank you. Thank you, Shuli. Correct. Okay, we'll see you. Please go out in 2 weeks. And those who make it, we'll see you this evening at 8:30 p.m. Rabbi Yechezkel Freundlich, Rabbi of TBDJ, Tiferet Beth David, Jerusalem in Montreal, will be giving the Parsha Shir. That's this evening at 8:30. Please go out tomorrow morning at 9:30. I'll be giving Pirkei Avot Shir. And Sunday morning at 11:15, Menachem Liebtag will be continuing his Shir and Sefer Dvarim. And then all our regular Shir next week, except for this one, which we'll resume in 2 weeks. Okay, we look forward to learning with you. Everybody be well. Have a wonderful day. And thanks a lot. Okay, bye-bye, everybody.
Thank you. I just answered this one last question from Mr. Barinholtz. I would not say that the king's agents are burying it, because they are coming out to destroy, right? I don't have the psukim in front of you, but if you look at the verses in Malachim or in Divrei Hayamim, they're not coming to bury. They want to get rid of it, right? To destroy everything. They don't want this to be around. They don't consider it holy. But you're right. I don't have proof one way or another. But if you look at the psukim, it's definitely talking about destruction. Okay. Thank you. Shabbat shalom.
Okay. Thank you. Shabbat shalom. Enjoy. Okay. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much. It was great.